This morning's Bible reading is from Hebrews chapter 2, verse 5 to chapter 3, verse 6. Now, it was not to angels that God subjected the world to come, of which we are speaking. It has been testified somewhere. What is man that you are mindful of him, or the son of man that you care for him? You made him for a little while lower than the angels. You have crowned him with glory and honor, putting everything in subjection under his feet. Now, putting everything in subjection to him, he left nothing outside his control. At present, we do not yet see everything in subjection to him, but we see him, for a little while was made lower than the angels, namely Jesus, crowned with glory and honor, because of the suffering of death, so that by the grace of God he might taste death for everyone. For it was fitting that he, for whom and by whom all things exist, in bringing many sons to glory, should make the founder of their salvation perfect through suffering. For he who sanctifies and those who are sanctified all have one source. That is why he is not ashamed to call them brothers, saying, I will tell of your name to my brothers. In the midst of the congregation, I will sing your praise. And again, I will put my trust in him. And again, behold, I and the children God has given me. Since therefore the children share in flesh and blood, he himself likewise partook of the same things, that through death he might destroy the one who has the power of death, that is the devil, and deliver all those who through fear of death were subject to lifelong slavery. For surely it is not angels that he helps, but he helps the offspring of Abraham. Therefore he had to be made like his brothers in every respect, so that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest in the service of God, to make propitiation for the sins of the people. For because he himself has suffered when tempted, he is able to help those who are being tempted. Therefore, holy brothers, you who share in a heavenly calling, consider Jesus, the apostle and high priest of our confession, who was faithful to him who appointed him, just as Moses also was faithful in all God's house. For Jesus has been counted worthy of more glory than Moses, as much more glory as the builder of a house has more honor than the house itself. For every house is built by someone, but the builder of all things is God. Now Moses was faithful in all God's house as a servant, to testify to the things that were to be spoken later. But Christ is faithful over God's house as a son, and we are his house if indeed we hold fast our confidence and our boasting in our hope. This is the word of the Lord.
Heavenly Father, we pray that by your Holy Spirit you would give us understanding minds and obedient hearts and wills that are moved by your Spirit. Amen. Well, you may have noticed it's not an easy passage, that. It's very densely woven. It's quite complex argumentation. And perhaps above all, it's rather alien to us, because this book, Hebrews, as you may have heard last week, was written to Christians who had a Jewish background, which we most of us don't have, so we don't know a lot of the background that goes with it, that was obvious to them. So let me make a disclaimer at the beginning. I think that would be a Haftungsablehnung. I won't be explaining everything. And here's a piece of advice for you. Don't try to understand everything. Now, it's not something I'd usually say at the beginning of a sermon. It sounds like I've given up before I've even started. But on this occasion, I think it's best to focus and chew on those things which we can understand, and not get preoccupied the things that are more difficult and not things that we can quite get our minds around just at the moment. And all of us will be at slightly different places on that. It took me quite a long time to get hold of what the writer is saying here, and I would have to say that I'm still on the way to understanding it in terms of the full logic of his argument. But one of the things I think was holding me back for a long time from understanding was a misunderstanding at one point. It sort of, I think, set me on the wrong track in trying to get the flow of the argument. And so I'll start at that point and see if it helps you as it helped me to get into the passage. Here's a question. Who is the he or the him in those first few verses, 5 to 8, which are mainly a quotation from Psalm 8? Well, there are plenty of reasons for thinking it is Jesus. We've just been told that he is superior to the angels. Well, here's another example of his superiority. The quotation from Psalm 8 is often used in other parts of the New Testament to refer to Jesus. It's seen as being fulfilled in Jesus. So naturally, when we come to this from a Christian background, that's the way we read it. And then we think, well, in view of the extent of the claims made for this hymn, well, it can only be referring to Jesus. So see if you agree as I read it through now, and I might use the name Jesus just to focus it. It was not to angels that God subjected the world to come, of which we are speaking. It has been testified somewhere. What is man that you are mindful of him, or Jesus, the Son of Man, that you care for him? You made Jesus for a little while lower than the angels. You have crowned Jesus with glory and honor, putting everything in subjection under Jesus' feet. Well, it would be impossible, we might think, to make those claims for anyone else. It must be talking about Jesus. And that makes sense of the rest of verse 8. Now, in putting everything in subjection to Jesus, God left nothing outside Jesus' control. At present, we do not yet see everything in subjection to Jesus. So, and that last bit, sorry to say, is we would explain that we do not see everything in subjection because his rule, his heavenly rule, is not yet recognized by all. Well, one difficulty with that reading is that it blends out the fact that in the following verse there is a contrast. It's quite hard to show you this. I will try, but don't worry if you don't quite get what I'm getting at. But the sense would be something like, if it was about Jesus, we do not see everything in subjection to Jesus. Instead, by contrast, we see the for a short time made lower than the angels, Jesus, crowned with glory and honor. It's more likely that rather than contrasting Jesus with Jesus, he's contrasting something else with Jesus. And I think more significant is the original meaning of the psalm. It is clear when you read the original psalm that he is writing about man. And for this sermon, when I say man, nearly every time I mean all humanity, humankind. The term son of man there was a common Hebrew way of speaking of human beings. It was only in the following centuries that it became a title which carried more significance and led to Jesus adopting it as a way of describing himself, as a way of emphasizing actually his humanness. That was why, almost certainly, he chose that term. But my conviction is that the writer is no longer making a contrast, as he was in chapter 1, between the angels and Jesus, but he's making a contrast between the angels and man. Let me read it again with that in mind. It was not to angels that God subjected the world to come, of which we are speaking. It has been testified somewhere, what is man that you are mindful of him, or the Son of Man that you care for him? You made man for a little while lower than the angels. You have crowned mankind with glory and honor, putting everything in subjection under his feet. Now, if that is the right way to understand it, it is quite a stretch, isn't it? That's quite a lot to get our mind round. I mean, it's not exactly the reality of our world, is it? We're crowned with glory and honour. Everything is in subjection under our feet. And so on. And it makes the last bit of verse 8 a bit of an understatement. At present, we do not yet see everything in subjection to him. But even if it is a bit of a stretch for our minds to get round, it is what David meant when he wrote it. That's why the whole psalm has a sense of amazement about it. What is man that you are mindful of him? In other words, wow, that's mind-boggling that you should be bothered at all with this part of your creation, humankind. For example, when I look at your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you have set in place, what is man that you are mindful of him? And that you have given him dominion over the works of your hands. You have put all things under his feet. Theologically, David was correct. We know from the first chapter of the whole Bible, God gave us responsibility for the whole of creation. Let me get the exact words. God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion, rule, over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the earth and every plant yielding seed," and so on. So David is right to be amazed, because it is true. That describes our God-given destiny as human beings. Destiny. I was trying to work out how to translate that, because literally it might be Schicksal, and it's not Schicksal. I think it might be Bestimmung. That is our Bestimmung. That is what God ordained, intended for us. Our destiny in that sense. So that's where we get our first heading, which we've actually got to the end of that point. Our destiny is described in these verses. That's something to reflect on if you ever find yourself feeling rather insignificant. You feel you don't count for much in the great scheme of things. You get no recognition for what you do. Very topical for Mother's Day in a society which think mothers who stay at home are a drain on society and not significant, not doing anything that really matters. That's really what the world around us is saying. And sometimes you may feel that as a mother. Well, I don't feel very significant in what I'm doing. Perhaps your experience at work or wherever is you don't get noticed. People sometimes treat you as if you're not there. And from within you feel, I'm not a person of any significance. But this is what God thinks. You are a person of destiny, and your destiny is to rule his creation for him. Maybe that's part of the explanation of why we long for significance as human beings. It's because we've been designed for it. It's hardwired into us. You may remember that in the book of Ecclesiastes, it says that God has put eternity in our hearts. So we have a longing, we have a sense there must be something beyond, something eternal. And maybe he's also put a longing for significance in our hearts. It's part of our being in God's image that we desire to make a difference and be significant. But as I say, that is a long way from the world as we see it. And that's partly why we instinctively see these verses as being about Jesus before they're about ourselves. And that's the cue for my second main heading, our destiny hindered, unsere Bestimmung verhindert. Sorry, somewhere I've got the outline, so I don't need to keep turning round to see what you're looking at. Most of us know what it is that hinders us, even without the Bible telling us. We sense it. We're hindered from achieving our destiny because we don't live the way God intended us to live. We refuse, in one way or another, to live our lives his way Or in a broader way, we refuse to rule the world in the way that is pleasing to him and that he intends. It's all summed up in that little word, sin, zunda. More important here than defining exactly what sin is dealing with the consequences. Later in the letter, we'll find the consequences of union in terms of the uncleanness that sin brings, a moral uncleanness, which means we cannot dwell in the presence of a holy God. We cannot even enter into the presence of a holy and pure God. But that's in the future. Here it's another consequence which is mainly in focus. Sin means we are under sentence, under a strafe. And even that is not fully explained, but it's what lies behind verse 14. Since therefore the children share in flesh and blood, he himself likewise partook, shared in the same things, that through death he might destroy the one who has the power of death, that is, the devil. So here's the logic behind that. Sin or rebellion against God carries the sentence of death. It will not be possible for sinful people to live eternally in God's presence. It's a sentence of death. That sentence is our destiny now, unless something is done about it. And the devil, in the Old Testament and New, is called Satan, which actually means the accuser. He loves to throw that accusation of us. Call yourself a Christian? Look at the way you live. Look at your sin. You're under sentence of death. And maybe the picture to have in mind is this. We're in prison. This is without Christ. We're in prison, locked up, and waiting for that death sentence to be carried out, not free to live the life that God intends. And if you like, the prison governor is the devil. And what he loves to do is to keep reminding us of our destiny as sinners. It's as if he walks past our cell door on a regular basis, jangling his keys and saying, perhaps, "You're condemned. It's death for you. That's your destiny." And so we fear death. As it says in the next verse, deliver all those who through fear of death were subject to slavery. We fear death not just because it's not part of what God intended, but because death will mark the end of the Lord's tolerance of sin. It means judgment. In fact, it is in itself the judgment we deserve. So we could sum it up as we fall short, we sin, we face judgment, and therefore we fear death, the death of judgment. And that in turn leads to this form of slavery, as the writer puts it there in verse 15. Through fear of death, we were subject to lifelong slavery. That is why we are hindered from enjoying our destiny. But as most of us know and believe, there is one to whom this did not apply. And he is the subject of our next heading, our destiny modeled. A forebilt, maybe, of our destiny. Jesus was one of us, would be one way of summing up verses 10 to 13 and those three quotations from the Hebrew Bible. Jesus was one of us. I'll just point you to the main emphases. We have one origin, halfway through verse 11. So he's one of us. We're all brothers. That's what the rest of that verse is saying. He's not ashamed to call them brothers. We're all part of one family with Jesus. Behold, I and the children God has given me. It's actually also there, the fact that he's one of us, in verse 16. But it's not as clear as it could be in this translation, but my dictionary, the Greek dictionary, did tell me that help, that word can be translated in a different way. It can mean to assume or take on the nature of, to übernehmen or anziehen. An old-fashioned English word was to don a garment, to put on a garment. And it has something like that. So verse 16 could be, for surely it is not angels whose nature Jesus puts on like a garment, but he puts on like a garment the seed of Abraham. And that is how he helps us. So helps is a good translation in other senses. He helps us by clothing himself with our humanity. And one of the ways he can then help us is given in verse 18. Because he himself has suffered when tempted, when he was cloaked in humanity, when he was human, he is able to help those who are being tempted, or it could be those who are being tested. There was nothing in the experience of our humanity which was outside the range of his experience. Nothing that we can experience which he can't have some sense of what it's like. It's one way in which he can help us. We can go to him when we struggle. So he modeled our destiny. He showed us what a human life looks like when it lives up to the destiny that God intended, the destiny written about in Psalm 8. And so from that point of view, it is actually fair to read Psalm 8 with Jesus there, because it's God's intention for all humanity, and it was realized in Jesus. What is Jesus that you are mindful of him and so on? But you made Jesus for a little while lower than the angels and crowned him with glory and honor and so on. Our destiny modeled. But Jesus doesn't only model our destiny. And actually, that's not even the main purpose for which he donned human flesh. In verse 10, we find him described as the founder of our salvation. That has a sense of being a pioneer. The pioneer who goes through ahead of us so that we can follow behind him. What is the path that he's been pioneering for us? And we think of that under our fourth heading, our destiny enabled or ermöglicht. It's really all there in verse 17, which is a very, very dense verse, which requires quite a lot of explanation, especially if we're not practicing Jews from the first century and used to the sacrifices in the temple. But it is something, the ideas in it come up later in the letter, so I'm going to leave most of the explanation to a later passage. Just one or two brief comments on verse 17. What is a priest for? Well, one way to think about it is to contrast the prophet with the priest. And if you're a visual thinker, think about their position. The prophet faces towards the people, bringing them revelation from God. So the preacher, if you like, is like the prophet, bringing God's word to God's people. But the priest faces towards God, bringing about reconciliation with God. He has a Godward dimension in his ministry. He does that by removing the obstacles that stand in the way of us drawing near to God. Obstacles that stand in the way of relationship with God. For example, the sin, the sinfulness we've already mentioned. Now that's actually what that word in verse 17, propitiation, is all about. And what verse 14 and 15 are about. As I say, I'll explain that word properly another time. But let me read 14 and 15 again. Since therefore the children share in flesh and blood, he himself likewise partook of the same things. That he also took on flesh and blood. That through death, through going, pioneering the way through death ahead of us, he might destroy the one who has the power of death, that is the devil, our prison governor, if you like. His power has been broken. And deliver all those who through fear of death were subject to lifelong slavery. How does he manage that? How does he liberate us? Well, let's go back, if you remember, that trio of problems. We fall short, therefore we face judgment, and end up fearing death. To put it in very simple terms, he faces the judgment for the ways in which we fell short. There's a little detail at the end of verse 9 which is quite revealing. It's that little word, actually, for. By the grace of God, he might taste death for everyone. It's for in the sense of on behalf of, anstelle. He tasted death so that we would not have to taste death on our behalf. He took on himself the judgment that was against us because we fall short. Fall short, face judgment. He took that judgment for us. As a result, he was able to conquer and defeat death, and we don't need to fear death. The prison governor with his jangling keys and accusations has been defeated. There is no accusation left to be made. He has destroyed or nullified the one who has the power of death, that is, the devil. So what is the particular emphasis here? He's been going on about the incarnation, that is the fact that Jesus was human, that he put on humanity and was fully human. I don't just mean he put it on as a sort of appearance. He was fully human. And that models for us what our destiny is to be, but it's more than that. Donning human flesh is a means to an end, not an end in itself. The Christian message didn't finish with Christmas. God became man. Important that that is. That was a means to an even more important end, which we've been celebrating at Easter. That end is to reconcile us with God, to set us free from the fear of death and the fear of being excluded from God's presence forever. And the only way for that to be done was for Jesus to put on humanity. Now, a priest, remember, facing God, if you like, the priest was a representative. The priest offered sacrifices on behalf of the people. Of course, that sort of priest isn't needed anymore because we don't offer sacrifice of animals anymore. Jesus himself was the sacrifice. It was a self-offering, with the result that we don't need to offer sacrifices anymore. That's why I don't like to be called a priest, because people tend to think of the Old Testament kind of priest, and we don't need that sort of priest. Jesus has done that. But a priest needs to be a representative. You have to be one of those you represent to be a priest. We've got elections coming up, all these placards all over Leipzig. I'm not sure whether I would be allowed to stand as a candidate for the European Parliament for this region. I probably am, because I'm a citizen of Europe. So I imagine that any citizen of Europe could stand in the European elections. I'm not sure. I'd be interested to find out. It's not something I'm straving after, don't worry. But one thing I do know for sure is when there's a Bundestagwahl, I do not have a right to stand for election. To be a representative of the citizens of Germany, I would need to be a citizen of Germany. You have to be one of those you represent. Jesus had to be one of us in order to do what was needed to bring us to God. That's the thinking behind verse 9. He was for a little while made lower than the angels, crowned with glory and honor because of the suffering of death, so that by the grace of God he might taste death for everyone. and it's the thinking behind verse 17. Therefore, he had to be made like his brothers in every respect. He had to become a proper representative so that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest in the service of God to make propitiation for the sins of the people. Let's just say for the moment, to be able to do the reconciliation, the versöhnung that was necessary between man and God. By going ahead of us, the founder, the pioneer, he blazed the trail through death that we can follow. He enabled our destiny to become real. But before you get too excited, we're not there yet. I don't mean we're not there at the end of the sermon. We are getting there. We're not yet enjoying the destiny that God intended for us. We're not in the new heavens and the new earth where righteousness dwells and justice reigns. Probably I don't need to prove that to you. And that's we're still in the world which by and large rejects God's rule, where people would rather work out their own destiny than submit to God's ideas about their destiny. And that's why the Jewish Christians he was writing to were suffering. They were facing pressure to turn back from following Christ and stick to following only what Moses had taught them. And that's why those of us who seek to follow Christ feel a similar pressure daily. The world around us is telling us we're wasting our time, waiting for a destiny which lies in the future. Eat, drink, and be merry. Tomorrow you die. Work out your own destiny, says the world around us. We're taking Jesus far too seriously. We should ease off a bit and not be quite so zealous, quite so fixated. So like them, we need to be reminded of the destiny that God has for us. Sorry, like the Jewish Christians back then. We need the reminder. And we can take comfort and take confidence from the fact that our destiny is assured. It's assured for at least two reasons. It is assured, certain, because it's based on events in the past, which cannot now be changed. For example, we'll read later, Jesus gives us confidence to enter the holy places, that is, enter into God's presence, by the new and living way that he opened for us through the curtain. He has done everything that was necessary for us to go through that curtain in the temple into the presence of God. We are free from prison now. We do not need to fear the jailer or the executioner. It's based on events in the past, what Jesus has achieved. And secondly, we can be assured because our representative did the job properly. How do we know that he did the job properly? That he was an effective high priest, not just a faithful one? Well, the resurrection is the evidence. He came back. He was raised to new life. That is God's seal of approval saying, dealt with. The final sacrifice has been made. The punishment has been paid. The judgment is lifted. The resurrection is our evidence. So one day in the new heavens and the new earth, we'll enjoy this destiny to the full with all our brothers and sisters. And of course, that means our older brother, Jesus, as well. But for now, well, we rejoice that we have this great destiny. None of us are insignificant. We are created to rule the creation, to live God's way in God's world, and run God's world for him. Nothing that we do is insignificant. It's all part of God's purposes for us and his creation. We rejoice that the destiny is enabled and assured, and we seek to live in tune with what we've seen of it being modeled in the life of Jesus. And along the way, we do what we can to help others to discover their destiny, God's destiny for them as well. But what we don't do, what we won't do, what we must refuse to do, is to give into the pressure from the world around us, the pressure to turn away from Christ, or just turn down the volume a bit on Christ, take it a little bit less seriously that we follow Christ. Let's make sure we are those who fulfill our destiny rather than fleeing from our destiny. And verses 1 to 6 of chapter 3 sort of flow on from that, encouraging us to consider Jesus, to ponder Jesus, to think about these things, all that he has done for us, all that he is doing for us, all that he has in store for us. And the writer makes a contrast. Look, Moses was great, one of the greatest, if not the greatest, of Israel's prophets. But Jesus is even greater. Jesus has been counted worthy of more glory than Moses, as much more glory as the builder of house has more honor than the house itself. Moses was faithful in all God's house as a servant to testify to the things that were coming later. But Christ is faithful over God's house and a son. And we are his house if indeed we hold fast our confidence and our boasting in our hope. Consider Christ and the destiny that he has made possible for us.